emotions are oftentimes at the core of the most powerful pieces of marketing. There's three kinds of conversations that most people have. There's a practical conversation, there's an emotional conversation, and then there's a social conversation. So the question then becomes, like, how do we actually get at that emotional conversation?
Charles, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. I'm super curious to talk with you, you know, because I think it's the first time that I have a writer and author on the show. Usually I ask people, you know, to present themselves. But in this case with you, I really want to go, like, you know, definitely to ask you not just about yourself, but can we go and, you know, walk through a typical day, right, in your life as a writer at the New Yorker? Like, you know, you wake up, what happens? I don't know if every day is the same, every day is different, but tell me about that.
Well, every day is kind of the same in terms of, like, how I spend my time, but what I'm actually doing is a little bit different depending on what stage of a story I'm in. So, you know, I live in Santa Cruz, California. My wife is a marine biologist, so that's why we're here. And then I have an office downtown, so I go to my office and, you know, most of the time I'm reporting. And so what I do is I literally just call stranger after stranger after stranger to see if they're willing to talk to me. And oftentimes, you know, there's someone I'm calling because I liked their papers and I've been emailing with them, and then they give me a suggestion of someone else to talk to. And so the fact that they've been suggested to me makes it a little bit easier to convince that second person to talk to me. But that's really, like, the job of reporters, just to kind of make phone call after phone call and learn as much as we can. And then there comes a stage when I have to take all of that and actually turn it into a story. And, you know, stories for the New Yorker are anywhere from 6 to 10,000 words long on average. And so oftentimes figuring out the structure of the story takes a long time, a lot of outlining. And then I start writing. And then we start the editing process and edit and edit and edit and edit.
What is usually the, you know, from you start talking with the first person, let's say, to going live?
So usually about 6 months for one article. And in the final article, there probably are only going to be about 5 or 6 people quoted, but I might talk to 80 or 90 people to figure out what I need to know.
And how is it different instead when it comes to be the, like, an author of a book, right? Because it is like the writer for the New Yorker, but you are also having a new book coming, right? Your latest book, Super Communicators.
It's fairly similar. The only difference being that an article kind of exists to just say one thing and can indulge my own interests. Whereas a book, you really have to be conscious of what the reader wants, right? You're writing this for other people. There needs to be an overarching idea that the book represents. So it can't be that you have, you know, 7 magazine articles that are all sort of, like, attached together. Instead, what you have to do is you have to find an idea that's rich enough where you can spend 80,000 words getting more and more complex into that idea.
And, you know, Super Communicators, we're going to go more into this in a bit, but who is it for? Is it for marketers? It is for, like, everyone that is interested in communication?
Yeah. It's definitely for marketers, right? Because marketers are communicators. They are communicating all the time, or corporate or CCOs, corporate communications officers, but also for literally anyone who communicates, which is all of us, right? If you're a manager in a tech firm, even if you're an engineer, you need to know how to communicate with your direct reports if you really want to make your team strong. If you're married to someone, or if you're in a relationship with someone, you need to know how to communicate with them. And so I would say that the audience for the book is anyone who communicates with other people. But for people like marketers, it's particularly important because they are in the business of communication. And so some of the science is really salient for them.
Can you tell me, like, a couple maybe of examples based on your research, like how to make the messaging, right, resonate at the best?
Yeah, I think every marketer knows that emotions are oftentimes at the core of the most powerful pieces of marketing. And so how do we actually elicit emotions, and how do we figure them out? Because there's a lot that, you know, you might see on TV or something else that it's obviously trying to be emotional and it just doesn't resonate. It feels a little sappy, or it feels a little inauthentic. There's 3 kinds of conversations that most people have. There's a practical conversation, which is about planning and decision making and fixing problems. There's an emotional conversation where the goal is empathy and to simply state how you feel. And then there's a social conversation, which is about how we interact with each other. So the question then becomes, like, how do we actually get at that emotional conversation? And what the research tends to show is that deep questions tend to put us in an emotional frame of mind. And a deep question is just something that asks people about their beliefs, their values, or their experiences. So think about the best ads that you've ever seen. rather than simply telling me something, it often asks something of me, right? It asks me to imagine a world where people are free and equal and we can sort of live in harmony. It asks me if that's something that I want. And when I answer in my own head and I say, yes, that's what I want, what I'm really doing is I'm becoming vulnerable. I'm allowing myself to become emotional. And so the best pieces of marketing, I think, when they use emotions, they don't try and club you over the head with it. They ask permission to activate that emotion. And because the permission is asked, people are more willing to give it.
And have you find anything that, specifically speaking, either for marketing on the brand side or even content creators, right? You know, on this podcast, we talk about a lot, you know, when it comes to the creator economy, what is happening there. Are you seeing like people on social media re-understanding communication? Do you think that, you know, I know that it's a broader topic, but have you find anything that you like the most or something where you, you know, analyze things and be like, I noticed that there is a pattern with creators or brands make mistakes when it comes to communicate, again, as you said, either a practical, emotional or social, you know,
Oh, yeah. So one of the things that happens a lot is that there's this thing known as the matching principle, which is that if I'm having an emotional conversation, you're having a practical conversation, yeah, or vice versa. If we're not matching each other, we're really not going to hear each other. And think about on social media, how many times people are not only not hearing each other, they don't seem to want to hear each other. They just sort of want to yell at each other. And then think of the folks who are very successful. Take Mr. Beast, for instance, right? One of the things that you see in watching Mr. Beast is that he's constantly asking the viewer questions. He's constantly inviting them in, and not just the easy invitation, like post below or like hit like favorite or something like that. Rather, he's inviting them to participate with him. He's in many ways, and this is through his demeanor and through his vocal tones and what he chooses to say, he's inviting the viewer to accompany him. I think that's one of the reasons that he's so successful is because he asks permission for people to align with him, to connect with him. And when you choose to, and it's, he's honest about what kind of conversation we're having. So some of these conversations are going to be emotional, and he's going to get emotional, and he's going to let that emotion show. He's going to demonstrate it. And some of the conversations are practical, just like, here's something crazy I want to do, and like, how do we make it happen? And that was so much fun. And instead of trying to make that emotional, giving it some veneer of emotionality that's not authentic, he commits to the kind of conversation that's occurring. And that's really important because humans are designed to detect inauthenticity very, very quickly. It's hardwired into our brains. And so a big part of communication is just finding the most authentic thing you can say, whether it's in a conversation or whether it's through an ad. What can I say that feels true? Because that truth is going to draw someone else in.
You said that people are easily understanding when someone is not authentic, especially new generations, right? They are very smart when it comes to social media, posting, whatever they read, right? So even in that case, for marketers, like, how can they elevate their messaging to be sure that they are going to have an authentic messaging to their, you know, people listening in?
Yeah, well, okay, so I think what's important is to define what authenticity is, right? So there was an experiment that was done where researchers would collect tape of, audio record friends who were laughing together, and then also strangers pretending to laugh together or trying to laugh together. And then they would play just a 1 second clip of all of those different recordings for listeners, and listeners with 90% accuracy could detect the difference between the people who are genuinely laughing together and those people who are kind of pretending at it. And the lesson there is that basically our brains have evolved to be very, very finely tuned to detect inauthenticity. And this makes sense from a social perspective, right? Because we can't police everyone all the time in a society. So we need to overreact a little bit when somebody violates our norms. If you're walking down the street and somebody accidentally kicks you in the leg, you'll be upset, but you'll forgive them. But if they kick you in the leg on purpose, you'll be furious. You'll be furious even more than the pain that they caused you. And that's an inborn trait. It's something that evolution has created within the human psyche. Now, the question for marketers then is, how do I respect that? And I'll be totally honest with you. I think if an ad makes the marketer feel something, then they can reasonably expect that it might make the audience feel something. But at But oftentimes I think that, and I do this, I'm guilty of this myself when I'm writing. We know that at this point I should tell a sad story, or we should have a character reminisce about something, because these are the tropes that we've learned. But when they don't feel real, they don't really land. And in fact, they make us even more angry. So it's much better to be authentic about something that's not as powerful as we might hope than to be inauthentic about something, because that inauthenticity will anger our audience. They will feel betrayed.
Hello! Is your brand ready to amplify its reach? Well, the Influencer Marketing Factory is here to do just that. We are a global influencer marketing agency helping brands ignite their growth, from influencer identification to campaign strategy, handling legalities and agreements to managing shipping and logistics. We have it all covered. We work with hundreds of brands across different verticals, from Fortune 500 companies to DTC brands. And we don't just stop there. With detailed ROI analysis, we help brands like yours measure success, transforming impressions into actionable conversions. You can find us at theinfluencermarketingfactory.com or just search Influencer Marketing Factory on Google.
Where do you feel there is more inauthenticity in terms of media? Is it like more on the TV side? Also, like social media, we're talking about authenticity all the time, but we found a lot of like scandals sometimes of people that were, you know, called out because they were basically selling off things that they didn't even try and so on. So are you noticing any patterns, any new trends when it comes to authenticity versus inauthenticity on media?
Take TV for right now.
Yeah.
Right now, right? There are so many great shows out. And I think one of the reasons we're living through this golden age of television, and I've talked to TV writers about this, is that so many of them are in a writer's room and they are telling their staff, don't just go for the joke. Go for something that feels true. And once we start, we'll start with a scene, and that scene, it's fine. It does the job, right? It's Friends. It's funny. It's quick moving. But it's not Better Call Saul or Breaking Bad, because those shows, they're still funny. They're not comedies, but they're still funny. But what they do differently is that the writers sit with that material long enough that they find something that feels authentic in it. And this is the other part of authenticity, is that oftentimes we know how to identify authenticity as soon as we encounter it. And so sometimes it's just a matter of sitting with an idea, sitting with a process, letting ourselves kind of wander through it until we find something that feels true, and then following that. I mean, if you think about it, that's actually the entire show of Mad Men is actually about that idea, right? It's about Don Draper searching for authenticity, looking for something that feels real to him. And when he identifies it in a product, that's all he needs in order to create some of the... Yeah, and of course, this is modeled after people who actually did that job and used this technique to find the messaging market, the marketing messages that we remember today.
Don Draper didn't have AI at the time, right? It was all his own creativity with his team, right? So first of all, like, you know, how things are changing having AI in the communication, like, what is your stance on that? Because some people are like, I hate it. I don't want to use it. Others are like, actually, it's helping me. So again, if you look at, you know, when you say Mad Men, for instance, that was like human creativity all the time. Now we have a lot of marketers that start using AI. Are we going to have new type of messaging, or is it going to be primarily the same messages just repurposed differently with the help of AI?
So I would say the thing about AI is the tool, right? And you know, it's like an axe. An axe can be used to chop down trees to build a house, or an axe can be used to kill another person. And so I don't know that AI is necessarily good or bad. I think that if we educate ourselves on how to use it, then it can be something that helps us. And, you know, I wrote an article recently for The New Yorker about AI and OpenAI and Microsoft and the relationship there. And one of the things that's really interesting to me is that if you look at, for instance, I have a 15-year-old. If you look at how my 15-year-old uses ChatGPT, he has conversations with it. He says that sometimes he'll read a book and none of his friends are reading that book. And so he'll talk to ChatGPT about the book. And it's not that ChatGPT is saying these like amazing things, but ChatGPT is asking some good questions. It's bringing up some ideas that maybe my son didn't think of on his own, right? It's drawing on everything that's been published about that book to have a conversation. Now, when I use a computer, I treat it like a calculator, right? I don't have conversations with computers. I ask it a question and I expect the right answer. But what my kid is learning is that when it comes to AI, we have to have a different relationship with the technology.
In this article, you said that, you know, all this is going at a pace. It's a pace gradual enough to accommodate the cautions required by short-term pessimism. And it's like, and only as fast as humans can absorb how this technology ought to be used. So you really think that we're going like, you know, at a pace where it's not overwhelming, because for some people it is, but it seems that you're saying the opposite.
No, I would say that I think the argument that that piece was making was that the people who are designing the AI, who are helping introduce it into our lives, they are sort of moving slowly in, because they understand that if they introduce it too quickly, it might alienate people. And the truth is, I mean, do you know anyone who like is like, oh, AI has destroyed my life? Like, I understand that like that's a concern, but like literally, do you know anyone who says like...
There is some people that are complaining, right? Because they're like, oh, my, you know, job is, you know, in jeopardy, right? So there are people complaining, right? And not destroyed yet, I would say, but we all know that there are a lot of, you know, artists or people that do data entry, right? That also for me, I'm not like either like for or against, like I also see that it's a tool. I personally love it. I use it every single day. So I'm more than pro for it. But so yeah, no one yet told me like, hey, I'm...
No, I think that's fair, right? That it is going to change the job marketplace a little bit. Like you know, if you're someone whose job is data entry, I mean, I don't know that anyone at this point actually still has a data entry job, but let's say it is. Let's say it's your job to type numbers from a sheet onto a screen. You're absolutely right, the AI, but that's not a job that necessarily should exist today, right? And by the way, artists and marketers who learn how to use this technology are going to be able to create so much more, right? As an artist, imagine for a minute, you know, if I come up with an idea for painting, I have to sit down, I have to paint it. It can take days, weeks, months. But if I want to prototype it and see how it looks, I can go and describe exactly what I want to Midjourney, and Midjourney will create a version of it. And I might say, and it's not going to be exactly what I have in my head, right? Because Midjourney is doing its own thing. But I'm going to be able to say, oh, no, it used a lot of blue. And now I realize I don't want any blue in this, right? This is not about the color blue. Or I can be like, oh, you know what? Like squids and spaceships, they don't belong in the same painting. So now I know that. And I know that with just about, you know, 5 minutes of work. As creating art in other ways, it's just a different paintbrush. And that doesn't mean that this paintbrush is the only paintbrush around. And it doesn't mean it's the most important paintbrush. Great artists and great marketers, they want to find a new paintbrush and they want to figure out how to use it. And that doesn't mean that they have to give up, you know, what makes them special.
But I like the idea of the prototyping. I've been seeing other, you know, already agencies and marketers, exactly what you said. They have something in mind. Maybe they want to present it to a client and they can give at least a quick idea in a few minutes before start working on it, right? So use it as a either inspiration or go through different ideas to showcase to the client, right? So you know, to start like, you know, wrapping on the different topics on, again, Super Communicators, right? Your book, we just like, you know, quickly went into that when it comes to the best messaging, how to resonate it and so on. I wanted to ask you, in the book, for again marketers, is there anything that you are really proud of, something that either you like really focused on after all your research? Is there something that you can only find in that book? And so what it is that?
So we're living through this golden age of understanding communication and this insight that there's these three different kinds of conversations. This is the first book to really explain that and to explain how these different conversations work. Take for instance, social conversations, right? Oftentimes we have social conversations when we're talking about the social issues, the things that have been in the news over the last 5 or 6 years or today. And oftentimes it's our instinct to ignore differences, to the fact that you grew up, I assume, overseas, and I grew up in the United States. It's very easy to pretend like that's not true and there's no difference. But the truth of the matter is, you probably have an interesting different perspective on, for instance, the U.S. election that's happening right now than I do, because you come from a nation that had a different electoral history. And inviting that into the conversation, that makes the conversation richer. It, first of all, shows that I want to listen to you, that I want to hear what you're saying. But second of all, it allows us to have a deeper conversation, a more meaningful conversation. And oftentimes what we found is that the best way to make that conversation feel better for everyone involved is to acknowledge that it, you know, it might be awkward, but then to say, these different identities that we have, they give us a different perspective on things. And I want to understand how I want to understand your perspective and I want to share mine, because in that understanding, we'll probably not only come together, but understand something more about the world.
This was a great way to promote it. I'm very curious now to, you know, read through all of that and learn a bit more about the topics.
Great. Thank you.
Charles, thank you so much for joining me today and for sharing all your knowledge with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
This was The Influence Factor by The Influencer Marketing Factory. I'll see you next week.